versus Johns. Mr. Hansmeier.
Please the court. My name is Dan Hansmeier. I'm an attorney with the Office of the Public Defender in the Central District of Illinois. I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Curtis Johns. This is an appeal raising numerous sentencing issues. There's a guidelines miscalculation, Townsend-Tucker issue, a rules violation, then an argument that the district court failed to explain the significant upward variance. On the guidelines miscalculation, it involves this 2K2.1, this application note that's, a bit confusing maybe. But I think both sides agree that there is impermissible double counting when one four-level enhancement applies on top of another four-level enhancement when the underlying conduct is trafficking in firearms. The government says, well, in this case you can still affirm because we presented other reasons. Our reply to that is the government or the district court did not accept those other reasons. The government would have a point if the district court said, by the way, I think the four-level enhancement applies for other reasons, and maybe we have something to argue about. But our position is simple. The record is crystal clear. The four-level enhancement's applied for the identical reason, and that is impermissible double counting under Application Note 13D. Therefore, the sentence must be vacated and remanded. That four-level increase made a pretty significant difference. The range should have been 63 to 78 months. It ended up being 97 to 121, and he ultimately ended up with a 160-month sentence. So, that's,
what would the statutory maximum be?
Well, each count carried 10 years, so if you stack them, it'd be 30. There were three counts. Mm-hmm. So essentially he got, basically I think the way the court sentenced him was the statutory maximum on two counts and then 40 months consecutive. Well, yeah, 40 months consecutive on the third, I think that's how it worked. So that's essentially our position on the guidelines miscalculation. And, there's obviously some discussion about the standard review. I'm not really going to discuss that because this court's case law is fairly clear that a guidelines miscalculation is plain error. Moving on to the clearly erroneous facts issue, that issue is essentially based on, the basis of those claims, cases from the Supreme Court, Townsend v. Burke and United States v. Tucker, essentially, and then expanding on those cases, this court has made clear that in the imposition of a sentence, if the district court says something that's factually incorrect, and that is a basis or even potentially a basis of the sentence, that is reversible error. And here, essentially, there's a discussion about the three guns that were involved, and multiple times, the handgun is referred to as semi-automatic handgun. It was not. That comes up in the statement of reasons.
So how is that a significant difference? I understand It was a revolver, not a semi-automatic, but
right.
So what?
Well, I think it's significant. Obviously, you can kill more people with a semi-automatic weapon. I think it's more dangerous. I think if you read the sentencing transcript as a whole, what comes across is that the judge, he imposed a significant variance. He's worried about punishing this person because of to protect the community. That's what I got out of it.
And the other erroneous fact is a miscount on the number of illegitimate children, right?
Yeah, we threw that
off
in
by
there.
One. Or
correct.
Something. Again, how is that a significant error?
Well, that, more strategic, Are we done with the gun?
I don't see the difference in the dangerousness. If the capacity is different, if the semi-automatic holds more ammunition than the revolver, but there's no indication he saw it that way.
Well, I think...
His concern was the multiplicity of weapons.
Well, I don't know that that's true. I mean, he continued to describe the weapons. Clearly, if he's just worried about three weapons, why doesn't he say three guns? I mean, he continues to describe these guns.
You're right, in the sense that the semi-automatic will usually have more ammunition, but also it fires faster. Right?
Correct.
But how does that... That seems such an insignificant detail. He has this really lethal automatic weapon. He has the shotgun and so on. So what if it's a revolver instead of a...
Let me give you some... You know, when you look at the case law example, United States...
Trivial. The judge isn't going to change his sentence because of that.
Well,
your first point is substantial. This point is... And similarly, the number of illegitimate children, that's utterly trivial.
Can I just give you one example? United States v. Gear, which the case from our office. The judge in that case, when he imposed sentence, said the offense conduct involved three weapons. It was only two. You could make the same argument. That's trivial. Who cares?
No. That's slightly different, right?
That's different. Well... To me, it's similar, and I can tell you that in that case,
look,
he got
a revolver and a nothing. Those are very dissimilar, right? And no weapon. That's very different.
Well,
from a revolver and a semi-automatic, which fires faster and maybe has more ammunition, has a clip rather than the barrel.
I guess just in looking at the precedent, there are very similar cases where you could make the same trivial type argument, and I would just encourage the court to look at those cases cited on page 34 and 35 of our briefs. On the children, essentially, I understand what you're saying on that.
Semi-automatics jam also.
Is that right?
Revolvers don't jam. Yeah.
Not an expert on guns.
Thank you. There are offsetting reasons for preferring one rather than the other.
Okay. You know, the children we worked in, essentially because of these comments made by the district court, and this seems to be an area of the law where it's not developed, but I think we found it troubling. Essentially, it seems like he got a longer sentence because he fathered six children from different women. And that just seems inconsistent with what federal judges are supposed to do at sentencing. And so we've brought that to this court's attention for that reason. Especially when you look at the actual facts of the case.
Well, suppose if instead of the number of the children, he just had emphasized, I think he did mention, the amount of unpaid child support.
I think that came up, yes, which is...
That's a kind of, you could think of that as a massive fraud.
Excuse me, I didn't hear that.
Think of that as a massive fraud.
Oh, a massive fraud. Right.
And certainly a judge can take account of that.
I think the child support is something, but just the general comments that concern us are this idea that he shouldn't be having children, I think is.
Well, I think he should not be having children, right? Because he can't afford them, as well as being a serious criminal.
I mean, in theory, I guess so, but that's not the way.
I don't know what's wrong. What do you mean, in theory? What's wrong with that point?
Well, the United States Supreme Court says that you have a right to bear children.
Oh,
so
come on.
I don't really know why you should get a longer
sentence. We're not talking about rights to bear children. We're talking about what kind of behavior justifies a heavier sentence. You go around, you're a criminal, you're violent, you have all these children whom you can't support, and you owe this very substantial amount. You're an irresponsible person, especially given his age, because he's sort of just revving up to high-level criminal activity just as he's reaching the age when most criminals, violent criminals, tend to be slowing down.
Sounds similar to what the district court said.
He shows real staying power, is what you say.
Yeah. That's one way of looking at it. I see that I'm in my rebuttal, so thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Hansmeier. Ms. Romero?
I think your partner would have helped you up there.
Yeah, for a judge. May it please the Court, my name is Jessica Romero, and I represent the United States. With respect to the first issue, above all, the position by the government is that any error was harmless. On top of that, based on the facts and the record in this case, there's ample evidence that the defendant did, in fact, both transfer the firearm with the knowledge that it would be possessed in connection with other felony offenses, and also possessed a firearm in connection with another felony offense, namely the intended murder that he discussed on one of the recordings. With respect to the second issue, and more generally, the district court sentence was procedurally sound, regardless of the issue of the number of children or the nature of the semi-automatic handgun. The only
one thing bothered me, it's very minor, but it does bother me. That's on page 40 of your brief. You say at the bottom, to the extent that the district court erred in incorrectly reciting the classification of the revolver as a semi-automatic handgun, a revolver is not a semi-automatic. And you should say that. It is not a semi-automatic. You shouldn't pretend. And then earlier you say the specific classification of the revolver as a semi-automatic handgun, which makes it sound as if, you know, it's just a terminology issue. Some people would call a revolver a semi-automatic. Others wouldn't. No, it's not a semi-automatic, right? That's a mistake.
That's fair.
Maybe inconsequential. It's a mistake, and the government should acknowledge it's a mistake rather than
I might tell
pretend
you, call
it's
your
a terminological you. Debate you're having with
Judge
the other
Posner
side.
Was a member of the rifle team when he was in school.
That's fair, Judge. In honesty, the reason I did qualify it is, and this is very collateral, when I Googled semi-automatic handgun and revolver, there was some indication that the terminology was used in that industry in connection with some types of revolvers. I'm not saying that that was the case here, and I understand, but that was my reason for being cautious. The government's position is the district court sentence was procedurally sound and reasonable based on the facts.
There's a serious problem with that double four-level enhancement.
Right.
It seems to be a double enhancement based on the identical conduct.
The PSR did state the trafficking as the underlying, the trafficking, subsequent trafficking by the CI as the underlying other felony offense. And based on the plain language of Application Note 14D, that is problematic. Our position is the error was harmless for two reasons. One, there was still the indication that the defendant was involved in the distribution of narcotics at the same time.
Yeah, but the judge seems to have based both enhancements on the trafficking. And as Mr. Romero pointed out, that has a really big impact on the guidelines range. The judge may still decide to give him the same sentence, but doesn't he have to, you know, reconsider in light of the fact that he failed to articulate a basis, the basis you're suggesting, you know, other separate activities, separate from the trafficking that would justify the enhancement?
This dovetails into the issue of the standard of review, which was disputed in the reply brief. The issue why there was no specific factual finding in connection with that particular enhancement had to do with the nature of the objection to the enhancement by the defendant before the district court, which was simply that the recorded statements by the defendant and the CI, which were the basis for the enhancement as applied by the PSR, were not reliable. That was the issue that was litigated, and the reason why there is no specific factual finding with respect to the distribution of narcotics or the intended murder that the defendant discussed on those same recordings was because it wasn't disputed. So as a result, the reasoning or the reason why there is no additional information in connection with that particular enhancement as addressed by the district court is because it wasn't contested for any other reason other than the reliability of the recorded statements.
Well, what about the exchange between Mr. Romero and the court where Romero says, just to have a clear record, the objection about the firearm is going to be used in connection with another offense, just to have a clear record, it was on the same basis as the objection regarding the trafficking. And the judge said it was the same issue.
That's correct, which had to do with the reliability of the recordings, not whether there was double counting, not whether there was any issue with respect, any factual dispute as to whether the defendant indicated he was also distributing narcotics or possessed the gun with the intent to commit another murder.
So you think that the Romero objection was just based on the sound quality? Is that what you're saying?
No, and to be clear, I'm Romero. It's okay.
Sorry. I'm sorry.
The reason I clarified with the district court was because there was basically one objection that was lodged against the application of both the trafficking enhancement and the other felony offense enhancement, and it was the same factual objection regarding the reliability of the statements on the recordings. So the reason for clarifying was simply so that there would be rulings with respect to the issue of the reliability of the statements by the CI
and
the defendant at the time that the recordings were made. The defendant's position was it was just puffing. It doesn't really indicate that he acknowledged that there was another felony offense potentially that the CI intended to commit in connection with the trafficking, and our position was that that was not supported by the facts. That was the only issue that needed to be resolved as a result of at the hearing, and that was the basis for both.
I'm sorry.
That's fine. That's fine. If there are no other questions.
Isn't there a problem with the district judge failing to ask the defendant or defense counsel whether he'd reviewed the pre-sentence report with his client?
It was the defendant, whether the defendant personally read the PSR. That's correct. Our view is that under the rule, the district court is required to do so, but the defendant's also required to establish prejudice in order to be remanded on that particular basis.
Well, if he hadn't reviewed it, he might not know that there was this dispute about whether the conversations included references to this murder and drug trafficking.
Well, I don't believe that's the case for two reasons. One, the conversations were recorded, so there's not very much to contest in terms of what was on the tape and what wasn't. And that's something that did come up they admitted that what was on the recordings was what was stated. It was only whether it was puffing or not was the only objection. So there was an indication that there was awareness as to what the statements were on the recordings. Independent of that, our position, too, is that the defendant can't establish prejudice because the district court indicated that even if it had not applied the other felony offense enhancement, it would have still imposed the same sentence. So our view is that even if the defendant wanted to object to additional...
The judge said that?
Yes, Judge. In response to my question at sentencing, which was, Your Honor, would you have applied the same sentence even without the application of the enhancement?
Oh, I see. Or
answered affirmatively. So our position is...
But did he give a reason why he would have reached that other than saying... Oh,
yes, based on the 3553 factors and the need for specific deterrence, Mr. Johns. So our position is, again, even if the defendant wanted to object to additional specific facts in the PSR or calculations in the PSR, the district court indicated that under 3553 it would have still have imposed the same sentence even without the guideline calculation in the PSR. If there are no further questions, we ask that the district court be affirmed. Its sentence was reasonable, procedurally proper, and there's no showing of prejudice or harm from any of the errors, cumulative or otherwise. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Romero. Mr. Hansmeier?
On the guidelines issue, I don't know if I'm supposed to, sorry if I'm supposed to wait for her. What you just said, Judge Posner, is absolutely correct. The record is crystal clear. The enhancements apply for the identical reason. I don't care what the standard of review is, that's error. Whether it's plain error, clear error, whatever you want to call it, that's error. If the government has arguments, other arguments, and it wants the district court to address them, this court can issue a remand saying consider the arguments.
But if the judge, if this, following up on Judge Tinder's question, if the judge says I'd give the same sentence even without the enhancements, or even without one of the enhancements, then isn't the question whether he's given enough reasons for this very long sentence to justify his decision?
Well, I think...
Right? Because he can depart from the guidelines.
Correct. I think that is an issue. And we addressed that at length in the reply brief. And when you look at the cases, there's this distinction between cases where a district court says, gives a reasoned explanation, and this sort of throw-in comment at the end. And that's a direct quote from this Abbas case, where the court essentially says it can't just be a throw-in comment at the end of the sentence.
But he does. He has given a number of reasons. Now, one of them was a mistake, the revolver, maybe not very a very significant mistake. And the five children versus six doesn't seem like a big deal. But he does emphasize the multiple guns, one of them a very dangerous automatic weapon, and his failure to pay child support, and the fact that he's engaged in violent criminal activity at an age when most criminals are slowing down. Why doesn't that suffice to justify his sentence?
Well, are we talking in the context of the guidelines miscalculation, correct? I mean, the problem is that there was a guidelines miscalculation. I mean, the sentence should have began, the starting point, and this is particularly important in light of Pew. I mean, Pew, when you read Pew from the Supreme Court, it's clear that this is, what do they say, the lodestone of sentencing? This is where you begin. If the starting point is 63 to 78 months, and you start at 97 to 121 months, and the only way the government says we know the sentence would be the same is because at the end of the hearing, the government stood up and said, hey, will you please say you'd impose the same sentence? And he does. That's not the sort of reasoned analysis that can justify such a significant variance. I mean, basically what we're saying is...
He made reference to recidivism, danger to the public, things of those nature, which he had discussed in his earlier discussion, right?
He quoted, he essentially said, I do so for the 3553A factors. That's what he said. He just listed them.
Are you taking the position that if the judge makes an error in guidelines calculation, he must resentence, even if he goes on and gives a really compelling discussion of why there should be a longer sentence?
I mean, I'm not making that argument in this case, no, because I just don't think that this one throw-in sentence at the government's urging can get us from such a 160-month sentence from the actual range. It's probably in here somewhere. I mean, the bottom of the range is 63 months, 160 months. Top of the range, that is a significant variance. And that needs to be explained. The district court needs to know that the range is actually 63 to 78 months. And would he impose a 160-month sentence in that case? I don't see how you can say we know that would happen on this record.
Mm-hmm.
So that's our argument.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Hasbrough. You were appointed, were you? The defendant, right. Sorry. Well, we thank you very much for your efforts on behalf of your client. We